This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We purchase back a little bit more electricity than what we use to make all of our butter, for example.
Many consumers out there have made the choice to be vegan, be it for the humane treatment of animals or because of the damaging impact of methane. Choosing not to eat dairy seems an ecologically responsible choice. But is there a responsible choice for those of us who enjoy a little Parmesan grated on our pasta? This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to the Director of Sustainability for Cabot Creamery, Jed Davis. We talk about water usage in dairy production, methane capture, the farm co-op model, and packaging for cheese products. Maybe there is a way for us to have our cheese and eat it too. Then we revisit highlights from our discussion with hemp evangelist and author Doug Fine. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jed Davis. He is the Director of Sustainability at Cabot Creamery. Jed, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how does Cabot differ from similar national brands, especially when it comes to sustainability, Jed?
Well, Alex, the fact that we are a cooperative, our farmers own our organization, gives us a heritage of listening to what's going on the farm at the same time as we're forced to listen to our consumers, those who are actually buying Cabot products. And it's trying to get the two working together. Ultimately, these are the sorts of dialogue that I think are so important for sustainability efforts.
And when you mention the cooperative angle, how should consumers view cooperatives? Sometimes it sounds like a dairy is just that one particular place, and then it's dairies, creamery versus creameries. How does this inform the way Cabot Creamery works? You have many, many farmers underneath this auspice of Cabot Creamery. How do you continue to keep standards high, and what does it mean for the finished product ultimately?
That's a good question. We have farmers in each of the New England states and across the lake over into upstate New York. So when we look at our pool of farmers, the farmers that provide us their milk, the quality is absolutely critical. And I think that as a cooperative, we have some ability to really work with our owners, our dairy farmers, to improve that. And the reason, in part, is because the farmers appreciate how important it is when their name, you know, their organization's name, is on the cheese that a consumer puts in their shopping basket. The real difference, I think, comes from that recognition that it's my milk from a farmer's perspective, and the cheesemakers can only make cheese as good as the milk I provide.
Well, how does that differ from, let's say, a Niman Ranch? Just from the term Niman Ranch, just that one term ranch, I thought the meat coming from that originally was just one ranch, but it's actually more of a standard. How is that different with Cabot Creamery?
In some ways, the parallels exist with the Niman Ranch in that we, in the consumer's mind, we represent a certain quality of product, similar to Niman, in our case with dairy products. And in addition, and I don't recall if Niman is a true cooperative or not, but in our case, you know, there's some comfort, I think, in knowing that the dairy farm families that provide the milk that goes into Cabot cheese have a legitimate stake in the business. So they really do have internal incentives to provide the best product possible.
Now, I want to dive into some of the details of what Cabot Creamery does in terms of its sustainability efforts. But first, I have a bone to pick with the dairy industry, especially when it comes to cheeses. Cheese used to always come in wax, but now when it comes in wax, it's still wrapped in plastic. Is there technology on the horizon that will allow companies like yours to eliminate having to wrap all of its cheese in plastic?
You're absolutely right that with wax cheeses, additional packaging is a challenge. For our specialty wax line, it's a regular bar of cheese, and then it gets dipped three times, the final coat being either red, purple, or black, and it looks really elegant. It presents really well. The challenge is getting the cheese from when we've dipped it in wax to the store shelf. And there just needs to be some level of protective packaging, or the quality at shelf level really deteriorates. At this point in time, it's mostly shrink wrap, I think, that you see in stores, or some sort of barrier film. But I agree with you. It'd be nice if we didn't have any additional packaging at all.
I mean, when I get that plastic wrap and I open it up when I buy some cheese, I immediately put it in wax paper and then put it into like a jar or something like that. I just don't even want that plastic on my cheese anymore than it has to be. It's obviously a lot less sustainable than, let's say, wax paper. Are there any like cornstarch plastic wraps that may be on the horizon for a company like yours? Or is that just not affordable at this point or cost effective?
Well, it's an interesting point, Alex, because one of the things, for anyone in agriculture and the dairy industry, that is, trying to advance a sustainability program, one of the challenges is plastics. In many ways, on both the farm and with our products, there are some applications of plastics that are really useful or really helpful in terms of, doing a variety of things. You don't need to go any farther than your local vegetable garden to see the number of people who use, black plastic to help grow gardens. Same is true when we're making cheese. There are some qualities of a plastic that can help in many cases as we're trying to get to a finished product. But what our goal is to see, as you suggest, are there alternatives that we can afford? And functionally, are those alternatives at least as good or transferable? And if none of those situations are the case, are there ways that we can then work with some of our partners to try and find a responsible way to either recycle or somehow else use some of those plastics?
Can you talk about how you measure sustainability at Cabot internally? For example, I know you use context-based sustainability. Maybe you can tell our listeners what that is and then how you kind of stack up different farms within your cooperative.
Sure. We've been advocates for context-based sustainability since we first came in contact with the concept, thanks to Dr. Mark McElroy, who is certainly one of the leading advocates for context in metrics around sustainability. The way I would describe it is, if you're serious about measuring your impacts, your sustainability impacts, most companies are very good at saying, okay, here's how much water I'm using today, and I have these projects to try and make sure we're using less water tomorrow. And that's good. I mean, that's a step in the right direction. But if we're trying to answer the question, are we sustainably using, let's say, water, you can really only answer that credibly if you take into account the context of availability in the world around you. So again, in the case of water, it's impossible to say, are you sustainably using water, unless you know how much water is available around the geography that you're operating in.
And why don't you talk about some of the ways that you try to put your cows to work, so to speak? They provide electricity for your farms in some respects. Can you speak towards those efforts, please, Jed?
Absolutely. We aspire to identify those closed loop systems where we can integrate both the cooperative side of our business and the commercial side of our business, which is to say, ways in which our farms support our creameries and the products that we make so that we can then further support our farms. A great example relates to energy. One of our manufacturing facilities is about 15 miles away from one of our member dairy farms, and we're able to take some plant organics from the creamery, transport it to the digester, an anaerobic digester on this farm, and that is then turned into electricity, which we then purchase back to help us run the creamery. We purchase back about, well, just a little bit more electricity than what we use to make all of our butter, for example.
And can you give us an idea of how your creamery stacks up to the largest creameries in the country? And how would that compare maybe to a Kraft?
Oh, I'm going to guess that system-wide, Kraft, yeah, they probably spill as much milk in a day as we process.
I see.
So, I mean, they're a major national brand. I would say we are a strong regional brand that has distribution across the country. But in fairness, depending on what state you are in, you might have to look a little harder to find us.
But a behemoth like Kraft, are they sourcing their milk and cream and cheese from Kraft creameries, or are they fairly agnostic from where they get their supply?
I certainly can't speak for them, but my impression with most of our major national competitors like Kraft is that what they often do is either source the cheese from someone who makes it on contract for them, or they may run some manufacturing facilities and then source milk as a raw ingredient.
And how does that differ for you guys?
We start right at the farm. So in other words, the owners of our organization are the ones providing the milk, and they provide the milk to our management team, essentially, that's in charge of turning that milk into the world's best cheddar. And ultimately, if we're successful in doing that, that benefits the dairy farmers directly.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the Director of Sustainability for Cabot Creamery, Jed Davis. Jed, what are the biggest challenges you have in the sustainability field trying to get all of your farms under the same standards? What are some of the areas where you really want to improve?
Sure. The nice thing about being in the sustainability industry, I think in any part of the industry, is there's never a lack of opportunity. We take our scope of work, if you will, and it's a broader scope of work because we are a cooperative. We take it all the way from the cow to the creamery, onto our interaction with our customers And although we may not directly impact our consumers, we know that everything that we do in that scope is under the eye of our consumers. On the cooperative side of our business, there's a lot of opportunity for us. We've been working with an organization called ManaMet, an environmental non-governmental organization who has helped us to develop a tool to help our farmers get a snapshot in time of where they are on a variety of topics related to dairy agriculture sustainability. At the same time, we're working on a daily basis with our manufacturing plants to understand how we can better get a handle of, better measure, and better improve our impacts related to manufacturing. And then finally, there's always that conversation with our customers to try and align our sustainability efforts with things that are important to them, as well as to inform them of interesting projects we're working on.
So I came up with my particular pet peeve, which was plastic packaging. What would you say would be the most common complaint, concern, area that your customers want to see improvement in?
Well, there's a few, although interestingly, in my mind, plastic is one of the big ones. I would say that's a bigger issue for us on the side of our, on our manufacturing side. But it has elements on both sides, both on the farm side and with our facilities. If I go to the farm side, certainly understanding impacts around water quality, that's a big one. I would say more broadly, there's the challenge of, proper management and optimal management of nutrients. We are involved in an innovation challenge with EPA called the Nutrient Recycling Challenge, where we're working with others, trying to get technology companies who have the sorts of technology that could provide real solutions together, and then see if we can't bring that technology more quickly to the farm level.
And I know that you're not an organic product generally. Why has that not occurred despite the large investment you've made into sustainability? And what does that really mean?
Well, we do have organic members in our cooperative, but you are correct that our product line itself is not certified organic. And, there's a lot of reasons for that. Some of it related to the flow of milk. Some of it related to being a cooperative. That has to be a cooperative-wide decision. All of our farmers need to decide if we were to go so significantly organic that we could be certified that way. Back to your question about a Kraft or a competitor like that, at the end of the day, they order what they need for milk. If they want organic milk, they order organic milk. In our case, we work with our dairy farmers, and it's basically a whole bunch of small businesses that are making decisions that we then try to help coordinate at a bigger level, at a collaborative level, so that we can provide the products that we make.
He's the Director of Sustainability at Cabot Creamery, Jed Davis. Jed, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Doug Fine. He's a comedic investigative journalist, best-selling author, and solar-powered goat herder. Doug, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It is fantastic to be with you, Alex.
So your new book is Hemp Bound, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. So why is hemp the next agricultural revolutionary product?
I have to say that the hardest thing about discussing hemp is not sounding like you're a roommate with the lava lamp, because as a seasoned journalist of 2 decades experience from 5 continents, you know, this is my 4th book. I came back from 2 years of field research and realized that your roommate with the lava lamp was actually right about hemp. The applications are astounding, and they blend in a very important way. They make sense economically to farmers and processors. They are going to help change our food and energy system, and they've given me, as a father, serious hope about humanity's climate mitigation strategies. How do you talk about that and not have people think that you're wearing a tie-dye? Of course, I am wearing hemp clothes as usual, but that you're not wearing a tie-dye, you know? That's the hardest part. The biggest application that I'm excited about vis-a-vis hemp is energy. Hemp produces an astonishing per acre yield of biomass. So at first I thought, when I started researching hemp, I thought, okay, ethanol, you know, from a non-food product that is better than GMO corn and soy as ethanol. And I quickly realized I was steered away by the experts about cellulosic ethanol not quite being ready for prime time yet. But what is ready for prime time is a process called gasification. It's allowing entire parts of Europe to wean from fossil fuels and, in fact, wean from their grid and allow themselves to produce their own regional energy.
This is different than coal gasification that we hear about.
It is. It's different than coal gasification, although in former coal country, in Kentucky, there's a super conservative utility owner that named Roger Ford, who is planning on planting hemp because one of its qualities is it will grow well in marginal soil, and using the hemp biomass in a gasification facility. So it's a relatively carbon-friendly way of producing energy from farm waste that would otherwise be unused.
Let's take a step back and give us a bit of a history on how and why hemp somehow got intertwined with the drug war.
Okay, let's take a step back 10,000 years. There's a recent find, actually 9,000-year-old in this case. A Stanford-led team a few weeks ago found incredibly well-preserved hemp clothing in a grave in Anatolia area of Turkey. So it's one of humanity's longest utilized plants on the food side, the seed oil side. The Persians have called it Shah Dinah for thousands of years, the king of seeds. It's the go-to high protein energy snack on the way to soccer practice in a place that doesn't have Doritos.
Right. What is this place you talk of that has no Doritos?
I think Iran, actually. I mean, I haven't been there in a while.
They must have Doritos.
Tajikistan didn't have them.
At least not no Cool Ranch Doritos. Let's just say.
Yeah, that's right. They're 3 marketing campaigns old. Right. So humans have used hemp for a really long time. Fast forwarding a little while. Gosh, there's so much I could tell you. Someone brought one of their family heirlooms, a 1731 book about the Dutch Reformation printed in Dutch, to an event I did in Colorado, and printed on hemp. And it's just this beautiful book that looks like in mint condition. Moving forward to somewhat modern, the Japanese emperor attends coronation dressed in hemp. The Thomas Jefferson's draft of the Declaration of Independence was written on hemp. Virginia colonists could pay their taxes with their hemp crop. It was that valuable.
And I learned in your book that Betsy Ross sewed the first American flag on hemp.
Yes, and a hemp flag, although not fiber grown in the U.S., hemp flag flew over the U.S. Capitol last July 4th, thanks to Jared Polis, who really, the congressman from Colorado, he really allowed last year to be, in the last 10,000 years, hemp's biggest year. He was able to lead the effort to insert a hemp cultivation provision into the farm bill that passed this past February. So 77 years of this terrible anomaly have ended. And one quick thing about, I call that an astonishing no-brainer, because as you said, it's confounding that this typo, I'll go to the banning of hemp here real quick and talk about those 77 dark years.
Yeah, maybe walk us back to 77 years ago and how that happened, if you can.
Sure. So 1937, the marijuana Tax Act was passed, also one of our nation's worst policy decisions since, you know, along with segregation and other DDT, other big, big mistakes of the 20th century, Japanese incarceration, that kind of thing. And taking our access to this hugely important plant and hugely economically valuable plant away for no reason. You know, even on the psychoactive side, the American Medical Association opposed the criminalization of cannabis in 1937. But industrial cannabis, which, by the way, so industrial cannabis is synonymous with hemp, and it's any version of the cannabis plant that has 0.1% of THC or less. Most everywhere else in the world grows it. Canada is about to broach $1 billion on its 15-year-old modern industry. Not that anybody listening here today will probably need this, but just so you know, there is no way to confuse psychoactive cannabis with industrial hemp. It's happened exactly zero times in Canada's modern 15-year history. So back to 1937. Essentially, in a typo, hemp gets banned along with psychoactive cannabis. This doesn't go over very well. Immediately, it starts shipping. Note, the drug war immediately starts shipping jobs offshore.
Were there any representatives of competing crops or anything that had a stake in trying to outlaw hemp?
There were plenty of players and industries that had an interest in hemp being squelched. However, we don't have a smoking gun on the most popular theories, and that probably have some truth to them. I'd like to time travel back to 1935, 1936, and have Hearst be in the club, the wood-paneled club with the brandies and the cigar with Hearst and DuPont and cotton interests and synthetics interests and paper industry interests.
Go kill Hitler.
And, oh, yeah, well, that was right. Okay, while I was there, but I'd probably do that before finding out the truth about whether or not hemp banning was a part of a big conspiracy. The fact is, there was a ton of reefer madness, yellow journalism, and, you know, ridiculous stuff printed in the Hearst newspapers, but that could just sell newspapers. That's just sensational stuff. He did that on a ton of topics. So the conspiracy theory, I if I were doing one of those myth-busting websites, I would say, you know, probably true, but unconfirmed. Nonetheless, even after the 1937 effective banning of hemp, and it, what it is cultivation now required a permit that was almost never given by the USDA. So all of a sudden, the Navy, which still needs 40 tons of hemp rigging per vessel, and by the way, the webbing on the parachute that saved George Bush Sr.'s life when he bailed out in World War II was made of hemp. All of a sudden, we're getting it from the Philippines, but whoops, 1942, Japanese capture the Philippines. And there's this fantastic, remarkable propaganda film that the USDA put out called Hemp for Victory that sounds like Your Roommate with the Lava Lamp. You can watch this on YouTube. It's like 13 minutes long. And it sings all the praises of the applications I will be talking about here in this chat about what hemp really does and what it has to offer and begs farmers to cultivate it. But we didn't actually get around to codifying the end of that prohibition until this past February.
Doug Fine, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Modesky Martin Wood and Prince. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.